Thank you for being with us today on Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and our guest today is Bob Peterson, editor of Rethinking Schools and a fifth grade teacher. Is it in Milwaukee, Mr. Peterson?
Yes, Milwaukee Public Schools.
Perhaps you could talk to us about the issues of education, which, of course, is why we have you on the program today. As of late, of course, President Clinton has spoke about his emphasis on education and that being a major component of the bridge to the 21st century. Of course, at the same time, it seems that our public schools, at least in many cases, appear to be failing a number of the students that are attending these schools. Certainly my perspective, and as I shared with you prior to the program, that I am particularly concerned with what appears to be a abandoning of people who are poor inner city, primarily black and brown children. The system seems to be abandoning them at just about every turn, including in education, in my opinion, and perhaps I'm wrong about that. So Bob Peterson, editor of Rethinking Schools, perhaps you could tell the audience about your perspectives on all of this.
Yeah, well, certainly the question of education is a broad one, but let's start with the most recent developments, which is President Clinton deciding to make education a centerpiece in his second administration. You know, he mentioned it in large part in the State of the Union address and in his budget proposals, and I think him highlighting education, because it's such an important issue as you laid out, is a positive thing. It's a step in the right direction. Unfortunately, his proposals, I think, are clearly inadequate given the scope of the problem, some of which you've described. You know, much of his efforts actually are oriented towards higher education in terms of tax credit, tax breaks. And when you look at what's actually being talked about in terms of targeting the kids who are currently underserved in our public school systems and in our private schools, there's not as much as really needed. I think when you look at issues of schooling in this country, I think one of the main criteria that people should use to judge effectiveness is around issues of equality and equity. And what we find is that on the level of resources, on the level of expectations, on the level of facilities, we have great inequality in this country. And so, like in our case in the Milwaukee area, you have children who are living in fairly resource-rich suburbs, in families where they have a great deal of resources, home computers, ability to go to private lessons and camps. And they go to schools, publicly funded schools, that receive maybe twice as much money as the children who live in the central city of Milwaukee, who live in a community or in families which are resource scarce. They don't have home computer. They don't have even a car to get their kids to a private lesson if they could afford the tuition in a private lesson. They don't have the summer camp possibilities. And yet the schools which they go to are funded at about half the level of schools of the more privileged children. I work at an inner city school, which is actually a very fine school, but our facility is 93 years old. It's, I have, donated computers, plugged into, power strip after power strip, sort of daisy chained, all along the wall, because the money hasn't been available for those kids. Now, money isn't everything, but it's certainly a good indication of what we think about our children. And Jonathan Kozol recently said that, you know, in our whole society, if we wanted to send kids a message, I mean, you could really look at how much we spend on their education. And basically what we're saying is those kids who are privileged, our society feels much much more indebted to, and we'll give them more money. They're worth maybe $10,000 a year. And those kids who come from less privileged backgrounds, who tend to be poor and people of color, well, they're worth maybe $4,000 or $5,000 a year. And when you think about it, to me, it's almost criminal in how we would treat kids like that. Now, So on the one hand, I have to argue strongly for changes in state tax structures and resource allocation. At the same time, I'm not going to say that money will solve all our problems. It certainly, I think, it's a requisite to improve situations. But even with a small amount of money or limited resources, I think schools can be and should be doing a better job. And that gets into a whole different area of things, which we can talk about. But just so for a start, I think it's good to view and assess issues of education through the lens of equity, because public education over the years, over the decades in our country, has in many ways opened doors to children who have come from families with less of resources, less privileges, and have enabled people to not only move up in society, but move broad, you know, move around and break out of traditional roles which they might have otherwise been pigeonholed into.
We're talking with Bob Peterson, who's a fifth grade teacher in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin City School System, and also editor of Rethinking Schools. My name is Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse, and thank you for being with us today on the program. Mr. Peterson, let me ask you this, because when you were speaking, several things came to my mind. One of them being that there seems to be, and perhaps it's my own bias, but certainly there seems to be, particularly, predominantly from conservative circles, that you know, the whole issue is about teachers, you know, teachers need to be better. And while certainly I think we can all agree that we want the best teachers available to be educating our youngsters, the other thing that I hear predominantly from conservative circles is the whole issue of vouchers and school choice and so forth and so on. It seems to me that many of the people who are forming and shaping the debate around education and who are creating the policies and those type of things are neglecting the inequities that are inherent in the way the system is funded. I mean, you know, how can you expect people to do well when, you know, they're not given the tools to do well with, you know? I mean, and at the same time, it seems these very same people who don't want to give the tools to the students primarily, and then the teachers who teach them, of course, at the very same time are looking for every excuse they can to further allow people with private money to abandon the system. You know, and so what you have eventually is one system for those who have nothing, which will be funded with nothing, as the rest of the people who can afford to, you know, go somewhere else and do quite well. Nobody seems to want to address this issue of inherent inequity. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, you raised both issues of vouchers and equitable schooling, and then issues of teachers. Let's deal with the issue of teachers first off.
Please.
Because I think, I mean, anybody who has gone through either a private or public school system, which probably means virtually everybody in this country, has had good teachers and bad teachers. I mean, I'm certainly not going to say that they're not bad teachers. I think some teachers are inadequate. They might have been trained poorly. They might not really have kids at heart. They might have been basically burned out because of a very difficult, you know, teaching situation or whatever. And that actually might add is probably true in most occupations. You don't have just great people 100% of the time in all occupations. The question is, what do you do in situations when you have a teacher who's struggling, a teacher in need. And for the most part, our school systems have not adequately dealt with that. Now, the conservatives will say it's all because of the union contracts and so on and so forth. But you could probably look in the states in the South, where there's virtually no union protection for teachers, and still find a fair amount of teachers who are in need of help. Teacher unions, on the other hand, will say, look, the administration has the power to do what they need to do to help or discipline teachers, but the principals are either lazy or so overworked that they don't get around to do that. And there's some truth to that. But I think a perspective which is emerging amongst progressive-minded teachers and administrators is that we really have to take on responsibility for our own profession, quality of work and services that we provide. And so you have programs sponsored by the NEA in Columbus, Ohio, and the AFT in Cincinnati, Ohio, which are basically peer evaluation and assessment programs where the teacher union has agreed and the district has agreed to spend a considerable amount of money to develop teacher leaders who actually go in, help teachers in need, and if after a year or two these teachers are proven to be inadequate, they recommend a dismissal. And what they found, this is a program that's been going on at least a decade in both the cities I've mentioned, they found that, in fact, teachers are more strict and stronger and have a higher rate of dismissal than the administrators. And the problem is, if then you take a look at the Clinton's budget, and he talks about the need to have the best teachers in the world, which is a reasonable rhetorical thing. And what he's doing is putting $21 million into a private program to develop what are called master teachers. So master teachers will, it's called the National Board for Professional Teaching Standards, and it certifies master teachers. I think the money would be much better spent if he were to help districts and administration, union, and school boards develop these peer assessment programs where the profession takes on responsibility for itself, deals with that situation. Because what he's doing is trying to get people to pass a certain set of standards to become master teachers. Well, my attitude is, I mean, I'm a fairly good teacher. I was a Wisconsin Elementary Teacher of the Year last year. I have better things to do than to jump through a bunch of hoops and get another certificate, like I have a lot of, spend a lot of time teaching. And the teachers who are struggling aren't going to voluntarily go into a program like that anyway, so I don't see that as a viable alternative. So that's my answer to the conservatives when they bash the teachers is we're not the problem. In fact, we're only hope if we have to improve the teaching staff. And let's work together to do that. Let's find some resources so teachers can take on some responsibility. Usually, conservatives aren't too fond of putting any amount of resources into public institutions, so that sort of falls on deaf ears. Now, on the issue of vouchers, though, that's very dear to my heart because, in fact, in Milwaukee, we have one of two programs in the country, the other one being Cleveland, where public tax dollars are being put into private schools through a system of vouchers. And I understand why some parents support this. Some parents, as you laid out at the beginning of this interview, are very dissatisfied with the quality of schooling that they're getting from the public schools. And they're willing. They say, hey, look at my kid. I want to get whatever's best for my kid. And I don't have time to wait for you to reform yourself. And that, I think, public school supporters, teachers, administrators, and progressives need to really listen to that and say, yes, there is something wrong here. Let's really both find, you know, more resources, but also apply the pressure necessary to make sure that public schools serve all kids, because that really is the solution to some of these problems. On the other hand, those legitimate sentiments are being used by enemies of public institutions, enemies of public schools. The program here in Milwaukee of vouchers, the whole political agenda is very much financed by the Bradley Foundation, one of the more conservative foundations in the country. They're the ones that gave Charles Murray $1 million to do his research in the book Bell Curve, which basically argues that people of color are inherently intellectually inferior. These people, Michael Joyce is the man who is the head of the Bradley Foundation, have made it very clear that they think that public schools are just sort of cesspools of radicalism, teaching feminism, environmentalism, and social issues. I mean, at some level, I wish he was correct. Unfortunately, public schools don't necessarily, you know, turn out the most progressive-minded kids either, in terms of some of these issues which he claims. But in terms of vouchers, there's a couple different things that need to be said. One is that vouchers are a diversion from the real issues. I think you sort of implied that in your statement. I mean, you know, as a classroom teacher, I'm less concerned with this alleged competition from private schools than I am with problems such as large class size, inadequate facilities, and a funding system that allows, you know, suburban districts to spend twice as much as per pupil as the urban system. Plus, and there's a whole issue of vouchers for religious schools. And many people, of course, feel that the separation of church and state is one aspect of our Constitution which is worth preserving, has worked fairly well up to now, and in places around the country where there have not been the church, places around the world where there's not been church-state separation, there's been some real negative things. I could say more, but I'll let's have you ask some more questions or comments. But as I said, I have looked at the voucher issue quite a bit and feel that it's certainly not a solution to our problems any more than the marketplaces has been a solution to the problems of housing or health care for poor people in this country.
We're talking with Bob Peterson, fifth grade teacher in the Milwaukee City school system and also editor of Rethinking Schools. My name is Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back talking with Bob Peterson, editor of Rethinking Schools. Mr. Peterson, you were talking certainly about the issue of vouchers. Let me ask you this, because I'd like to let the listeners know a little bit about what Rethinking Schools is all about, and I think the name certainly will give a lot of clue to that. Can you let the listeners know about what Rethinking Schools is attempting to do here?
Sure. Rethinking Schools is a quarterly publication. It comes out in tabloid format, and it's been around for 11 years. We started, a bunch of teachers and community activists started it in Milwaukee because we felt that the local press was never really going in depth around school issues, and that many of the education periodicals from universities and teachers' unions and associations never gave the perspective of the practicing teachers, or more people who've sort of graduated from teaching and now can tell us how to do it. So we started this publication in Milwaukee. We use it both, it's both now a national publication and still a local publication. We distribute 20,000 copies free in the Milwaukee area as a sort of a political endeavor, trying to raise issues and push public policy in the Milwaukee district in certain ways, and we've had some success in that area. We also distribute it nationwide on a subscription basis, and but we do more than just the paper. One of the things that we feel very strongly about are some of the equity issues, which I talked about on a policy level, but also in terms of classroom practice. Several years ago, we published a booklet called Rethinking Columbus, which was for the quincentennial of Columbus's arrival here. And it was actually sort of amazing. It was a 96-page booklet, which is still available from us, teaching ideas, interviews with Native Americans, basically Native American perspective. And we published 30,000 copies initially, which actually is quite a bit. And once word got out that it was around, we were flooded, literally 100, 200 requests a day for the materials. Teachers, there's a lot of progressive teacher and community people out there who know that the story that most kids get in public schools and private schools is pretty one-sided, sort of the history of those who have who have benefited from things in our society. And so, and we've sold now over 210,000 copies. We price our materials very inexpensively because we want them to be used. We are a nonprofit group, and we certainly want these ideas out and used by people. In fact, I'll give your listeners a toll-free number they can call during regular business hours to order a free brochure. The number is 1-800-669-4192. That's 1-800-669-4192. We also have put out a book that about this subject that we've just talked about called Selling Out Our Schools, Vouchers, Markets, and the Future of Public Education. And it's about a 90-page magazine-style format, which has a couple dozen articles from around the country that examine what the title says, Vouchers and Markets is the Future of Education. And it's a very readable format and useful for anyone who is concerned with the issue and would like to either educate themselves or policymakers in their area.
We're talking with Bob Peterson of Rethinking Schools. Mr. Peterson, let me ask you this. Where do we go in really attempting to create an effective education system? It's interesting. Out here in California, of course, we have our own, I think, sometimes particular problems. It's amazing some of the things that happens regarding public education out here. I know, and I don't particularly consider myself to be an overly intelligent person, but I look now at, some of the young people that I talk to, and frankly, some of these kids, they can't hardly spell. They can barely put a sentence together. Something I think is drastically wrong. I mean, we can agree with that, right?
Absolutely. And it's, I see it, I've been teaching now fifth grade for about 16 years, and I've seen a change, with kids, and I've been mainly dealing with the same kind of, kid who doesn't have a lot of privileges at home, although a few do, but what I've seen, I'll tell you, don't like to throw stones at other institutions, but the mass media, the advent of video and video games in particular, is really frightening. It was interesting. I do assignment with kids. We analyze the media, analyze our own habits, and we had one day the kids had to just put down what they did every half hour in their life, starting at the beginning of the school day until the next school day. And then we used that data for work with percent and fractions and decimals and stuff. And we took it, said, well, how much TV do you watch? And it ranged from none, some kids didn't watch any that day, to 9 hours. One child had watched 9 hours in the 24-hour period. He had also attended school, so it was a pretty interesting feat. But then we said, okay, now what we're going to do is you're going to take how much TV you've watched and estimate, if that's accurate, how much you watch for the whole week. And then we multiplied how much in a year, how much in 10 years, how much will you have watched in a lifetime? It's pretty frightening when people do that, actually, to see basically years of their life will be spent in front of the tube. But there are four kids in my classroom who raise their hands and say, well, I don't really watch TV for whatever reason. Their parents are particularly not too thrilled about it, or at least they didn't watch TV that night. They might watch a little on the weekends or whatever. And so we had to have them come up front, and we did a little different activity while the other kids were sort of doing their calculations on their own TV watching. It turned out that those four kids are the best readers in my classroom, the best writers in my classroom. And I don't think it's just coincidence, because, in fact, those kids had spent time that evening doing some reading, perhaps some writing, I'm not sure. And so one of my feelings are is that I think kids in some ways get a bum rap in the sense that, yes, I have a lot of criticism, but in fact they're reflecting our society. I mean, if you look at what Hollywood puts out in terms of the sitcoms on TV or even many of the movies, the kids just reflect that. I mean, kids are more and more these days try to resolve conflicts through put-downs and physical force. At least that's been my experience with, I work with 10, 11, and 12-year-olds. And, turn on, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock soap opera, or sitcom on TV, basically, it's the put downs on the sitcoms and on the commercials, you get a lot of the violence. Some of the TV shows are violent too. Now, I'm probably starting to sound very conservative, in this regard, but I think when people, lash out at kids, I think it's really, a more of an issue of, you know, what are the values that we're, holding up in our society as a whole? And I think, there's some real problems with it. Now, my solution isn't the William Bennett, let's, censor all this stuff and, go back to the good old days, because I think, you know, the good old days when there was slavery and women couldn't even wear dresses with pockets and couldn't speak in public aren't really good. They might be old, but not good. So there's a lot of misconceptions there, but I think we have to look in and say, well, why? We have to ask the question, why? Why does Hollywood produce these kinds of things? What are the motives behind, some of the commercialization that's going on? And to me, the motive comes down to somebody's making a buck off it. The profit system where people have not decided to put human needs or human values ahead of the almighty dollar. And you have a situation where if it makes money, it works. And who cares about the social consequences? And until our society wakes up to that, and I think we're still going in that direction, unfortunately, I think we're going to have an increasingly deteriorating social milieu that affects all people, but it particularly affects our children. And as a teacher who works with kids, it's frightening. Some days I come home so depressed, even though our school is progressive and we do good things at our school, I just see what some of the kids are going through and some of their attitudes, and I think, you know, this is really out of hand in this society.
Well, certainly, I can agree with you on that. I was just reading a quote the other day, which seems to be very appropriate to a lot of things that's going on. I cannot actually quote it. I think it was Fred Astaire, and he said, one of the hardest things in the world is for kids to learn values and morals when there isn't anyone around showing them any. And, you know, certainly there does seem to be a lot of, you know, kid bashing. I know in our local area here, we have a lot of that with these kids and those kids. And we've even had, some of them referred to as maggots by, some of our quote unquote leading, business people and, social luminaries. Of course, as you so clearly stated, I think, where are these kids, you know, learning the things that we then turn around and blame them for learning? Well, they're learning them from us.
Right.
And nobody wants to deal with that part of it. We're talking with Bob Peterson of Rethinking Schools, who also happens to be a fifth grade teacher in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin city school system. My name is Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse. We'll be back in just a moment. We're back talking with Bob Peterson of Rethinking Schools. Mr. Peterson, let me ask you this, because you kind of got me off on one of my favorite topics, and that is Bill Bennett. One of the things that I see is, you know, I see Mr. Bennett and his Book of Virtues, and that in particular I'm thinking about in one of our local public schools here, I know, is the favorite book of one of the people who's involved there. I have some real problems with that method. Can you talk about your perception of the usefulness of Mr. Bennett and his Book of Virtues?
Well, I think it's interesting to again ask some questions. If he's so virtuous, you know, why did he come out and condemn Newt Gingrich for holding out an olive branch to Jesse Jackson recently, basically condemned him for trying to organize the left wing of the Democratic Party. And I have no love for Newt Gingrich either, but it seems to me to be a virtuous thing to do, to have conversation with political opponents, even if we disagree with them. I think that's one of the things that is necessary in any institution or society that claims to be democratic. And so when I see things like that by William Bennett, I take anything he says then with a little less respect. In terms of some of his particular messages, you know, he has this Book of Virtues, which has a lot of short stories and poems and vignettes, and you know, some of them are fine. I mean, you collect enough of them, you can't go wrong. I mean, some of them are very classic Western European stories. Yeah, there's a few that go beyond that pale, but I think what I have problems with him and also this guy Hirsch, who has put out, you know, what your fourth grader should know and what your fifth grader should know, and E.D. Hirsch is his name, he put out the book Cultural Literacy, is that, yeah, I think that, I mean, I do agree that kids need a certain level of information, facts. I mean, the kids in my school should know they live in Milwaukee and the state of Wisconsin. They, you know, I think kids should know that Clinton is president and Florida's a peninsula. I mean, there's some, you know, there's some things that are basic information that if you don't know, you become very disempowered and you can't really function as a full citizen. However, when you take a closer look at the content of what people like Bennett and Hirsch are putting out there, it's very much biased in favor of what a Eurocentric point of view. And that's problematic for all of our students, certainly for the non-European or heritage kids, but even for the European heritage kids, we need, and I'm speaking as one, I need as much information and knowledge about different cultures as possible to function as a civil human being in our society. And I too often feel that school districts fall down on this issue. I personally believe that schools should have as a policy the teaching of kids to be anti-racist, to explicitly teach kids that racism is scientifically unfounded, that it's historically horrific and morally incorrect. You know, you don't see people like Bennett and Hirsch really care that much about it, and yet it's clear that issues of race and gender discrimination have divided and continue to divide our country very dramatically. It seems to me it would be the appropriate role for schools to try to counter some of the age-old prejudice which continues, so that maybe then the kids, as they grow up, can challenge some of the more institutionalized forms of that prejudice. So that's my basic take on that perspective. I think that the other aspect of it is, it's not just a matter of what of facts that the kids need to know. This is where I get into some of E.D. Hirsch's criticism of his. I mean, kids really need to know how to apply facts and critically look at, quote, facts, because, and they need to learn that no matter what they're reading or seeing on TV, has something behind it. What I mean by that is that they should ask, like, whose interest is this information in? You know, from whose perspective is this information coming from? And if kids sort of develop the skills to ask those questions about everything, whether it's the presidential State of the Union address or a newspaper article or a radio show, an interview like this one, I think they'll be much better equipped to become fully active as participants in our society.
The unfortunate part with that, of course, is that there seems to be a number of people who would just as soon have a society of people who really cannot do that type of critical analysis. I'm thinking in terms of, you know, corporate advertisers. I think they would just assume that people sitting in front of the television would just accept whatever they say as the truth of the matter. I mean, you can tell that by the way they sneak all the fine print stuff in at the end very, very fast. We're talking with Bob Peterson of Rethinking Schools. And Mr. Peterson, let me ask you this, because we're going to be working our way towards running out of time here in not too long a period of minutes, but let me ask you two things. I guess first, I'd like to ask you, do you think that teachers and school administrators stand up for what they believe is right enough? It seems to me, and you know, once again, this is just my opinion, that perhaps if more teachers and administrators stood up in a unified group and started challenging, you know, some of these things that are put out by primarily politicians, you know, because, you know, superficial rhetoric works very well in raising emotional buttons and getting votes, even though a lot of that rhetoric, when you examine it, is pretty far from the truth. It seems to me that, you know, that not enough teachers and school administrators stand up and say, no, that's not right. Here's what's going on. And you know, we're going to, you know, to challenge you on that. And that doesn't seem to me to happen enough. Is that, am I out in left field here?
No, I agree with you there. And I think, it's a problem, for teachers and administrators. And it's also a challenge to people who are active in teacher unions, because, and I am a supporter of unions. However, I think that they certainly play a contradictory role, because, you know, in the history of unionism in this country, there's also been union. One of the roles has been to protect those people who are in the union, whether it's through exclusionary policies against people of color and women, or through other mechanisms. And I think how that applies to teachers is, historically, teacher unions have tended to, not universally, but tended to just look out for the interests of their members, and not paid enough attention and understood the connection between the quality of services that teachers provide and the community which we're allegedly serving. So I actually work with another group on a national level called the National Coalition of Education Activists, and one of the things that we promote is what we call social justice unionism. We believe that teacher unions should have as their goal the promotion of social justice. Actually, I think all unions, well, I think everybody should. But teacher unions are in a very unique position, because teachers see the consequences of the great injustices in our society. We, you know, we work with kids every day, many of whom suffer because of the injustices around job discrimination, the corporate welfare, housing policies, healthcare inadequacies, and so on. And so I think it's really incumbent upon us, as people who see kids in need, to say, no, society, time out. We need, as an association, as a union, to start working with other groups in the community, other political groups, other community-based groups, religious groups, and push for policies that will serve all children. And in that way, we'll improve our entire society. So I strongly agree with you there. If anybody's interested in, amongst your listening audience, to get information on the National Coalition of Education Activists, they can just, you know, contact Rethinking Schools, and we'll be happy to give them the information.
We're talking with Bob Peterson of Rethinking Schools, and Mr. Peterson also happens to be a person out on the front line as a fifth grade teacher in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin City Schools District. So he's not sitting in some ivory tower or think tank coming up with this stuff. He's actually in the classroom and knows what's going on, which, you know, frankly, I mean, I think there are a lot of people who talk about education and talk about what we should be doing or shouldn't be doing who haven't been in a classroom, in some cases, in their entire lives, and in many cases, for many years.
Yeah, actually, you know, I have a policy that I promote that nobody seems to have adopted, but that administrators, principals, central office people, union presidents, and university professors should go back to the classroom at least one semester every 5 years, and not just one day 5 years or something. And I think they would have a much different perspective on how to promote a change within the school district. Now, this is to say nothing about the state legislators who are, you know, passing one education policy after another, based on virtually no experience whatsoever. But I do really believe in what you said, that people need to listen not only to the teachers, but to the students and to the parents, who certainly have the best interests of their kids at heart. And we need to encourage, one thing in Wisconsin we're trying to push is encourage some laws on the state level that will allow parents to leave their work with pay, without any penalty, to come to teacher-parent conferences or to come and observe in the classroom for a day. Because I think it is very important in districts, in all districts, that parents come in. And as you know, it's much easier for parents who are in a professional, middle-class type job situation to take off and deal with a problem in their kid's school than a parent who is struggling, and if they miss one day of work, they're out of a job. So those kind of social policies should be put in place so that all parents have more of a chance to influence the education of their kids.
Mr. Peterson, what do you think, and if you can sum it up in a minute, would be the number one most important task for our listeners to engage in if they really wanted to impact what's happening in our school system and make it a more positive and effective experience for the students there?
Well, my rule of thumb about this issue, as with any other issue in the society, is that unless people get together, analyze the situation, talk about it, educate themselves and each other, and then organize, we won't get anything done. The powers that be in this society, whether it's around issues of the military budget or health policy or jobs and employment, aren't going to move if somebody's not pushing them. And the same is true with schools. And it's unfortunately, sometimes it's true with the school down the street and the building principal and the teachers. They might have gotten into a habit which is not so positive in terms of how they work with the kids. So my recommendation is that people who are concerned seek out like-minded folks and read things like Rethinking Schools and other publications and use that as a basis for organizing projects on the issues which they feel are most important in their locale, hopefully linking up with, you know, state and national issues. Because ultimately, one local school can make some progress, but unless we overhaul the system of finance, unless we overhaul teacher training and our approaches to kids on a much broader level, you're not going to have a lot of success at the local school, at least in the long run. So, again, Alan, let people know that if they're interested in Rethinking Schools, to contact us at 1-800-669-4192. That's 1-800-669-4192. And ask to for a list of our publications, and hopefully they'll be useful in the struggle for just and equitable schools and society.
Bob Peterson of Rethinking Schools, thank you for being with us today on Full Logic Reverse.
Thank you.